You're listening to Amphibicast.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining me again. In previous episodes, I've had the pleasure of speaking with a variety of amphibian experts on a whole host of amphibian disease and ecology issues. However, there's been one issue that I've really been dying to get into detail about, and I'm fortunate to have an amphibian disease ecologist here with me tonight to answer my questions. So how cool is that? This particular concern, though, is the focus of tonight's discussion has really taken on a sense of infamy, if you will, and justifiably so, since disease has factored so significantly in global amphibian decline. And if you haven't already guessed it by now, the topic is chytrid, or specifically, and I'm going to do my best to pronounce this because I never use it in spoken conversation, but we've got Batrachochytrium dendrobatidis. Oh God, I butchered that. I know. I butchered it. Sorry, folks. But colloquially, it's known as BD. And as I alluded to earlier, it's my pleasure tonight to have an expert on BD. And her name is Dr. Tegan McMahon, and she is an assistant professor at Connecticut College, and she's going to talk to us tonight all about it. So, Tegan, Dr. McMahon, welcome. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Having me on the show, this is awesome.
It's my pleasure. I'm so sorry. We talked a little bit off air about pronunciation, and I totally butchered the full scientific name of BD. So
that happens to me too. I have to practice it several times before I give a talk. So I say Batrachochytrium dendrobatidis, but I think it's pronounced in a whole bunch of different ways by different people.
Yeah, I mean, it's you'd have to find someone who's a scholar on dead languages. Oh, I mean, there's plenty of Latin and Greek scholars out there. I actually took Latin, yeah, a long time ago, but again, I don't really hear it in conversation come up so much. But enough about that. Tell us about you. Why don't you tell us about your story? What were your earliest experiences with amphibians like, and what led you to where you are today?
Yeah, so I have been running around in the woods and playing with tadpoles and frogs since I was a really little kid. I grew up in a household in southeastern Connecticut, and I did not have a TV or anything like that. We spent most of our time hiking, biking, walking in the woods, and my folks would take us out looking for frogs and tadpoles. And by the time I was like five, I could identify the difference between the different species of eggs in the pond and things like that. I've always loved it. There's something about when you're walking down the road and you can hear the frogs calling, that's just a really wonderful sort of memory and feeling for me. So I think that's those experiences really held through. And so when I went to college, I studied biology. Leaving college, I got the opportunity to teach in Costa Rica, and I got to sort of immerse myself in experience in the jungle and seeing all the different tropical species there. And I knew that I needed to work to try to do something to help save and sort of stop the decline of these really amazing species. I've been on the same sort of track. I feel real lucky in that I knew I always wanted to be an ecologist of some sort. And ever since I was a really little kid, there's in fact a picture of me catching a toad at the age of two, because I've just really loved them so much. I don't recommend that to other folks, but
that's great. Where did you grow up? Was there a lot of native amphibians where you grew up?
Yeah, I grew up in Knowing, Connecticut, which is funny because I just recently returned back to the same area. But there are a lot of different frogs in the area that are native. The spring peepers are really some of the frogs that are most sort of iconic for this particular area. Absolutely gorgeous populations of frogs when I was younger, and then there's some really amazing salamanders, newts, and things like that in the area as well, like the beautiful spotted salamanders with the bright yellow spots and these red back salamanders. And sometimes when you go a little bit further out, you can find those orange newts. It's the F's in the spring. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, there's nothing like seeing native species out in the wild, just kind of finding them, especially when you're not even looking, when you just kind of find them haphazardly. Like I put up a picture on Instagram a couple of months ago about a salamander that I just found on the job while I was working. I actually found it 2 feet underground in a water main pit on the property that I work on. Yeah, but it was exciting. It was fun to see one, and it was surprising because it was so tiny.
Yeah, they can really vary in size. Sometimes you see the really skinny, long ones. Yeah, I love them. I think you're right. I think like the sort of spontaneity of looking around and suddenly there's a little creature right there, and they're so delicate but so fast, and they've been so resilient for so long. It's kind of an amazing combination of features.
Yeah, and it also bit me, and I was surprised that something so small could have such a formidable bite. But yeah, it got me.
Oh, that's funny. I don't think I've ever been bitten by one before.
Yeah, it was a fun experience. You try it sometime. What was it like teaching in Costa Rica? Because, I mean, here in the U.S., for my international listeners out there, I know certain people, like in the U.K., you guys have not a tremendous amount of biodiversity, and continental Europe is a little bit different, but here in the United States, we've got a tremendous amount of biodiversity, particularly with salamanders, and people don't always realize it here in the country. We always think of places like Costa Rica and Panama and Suriname having way more amphibian biodiversity than we do here. But what would you say some of the differences were between here on the East Coast of United States and Costa Rica in terms of just the volume of species, or like what was it like comparing it to?
Yeah, it was a pretty incredible experience teaching down there. I taught after my undergrad before going back to school for my PhD, and then I've gone back to Costa Rica and to Panama to do research throughout my career since, because they're both really incredible places to be. In terms of biodiversity, the biodiversity there is so incredible that you end up sort of learning groups of organisms in the beginning. So rather than learning like individual species when you see them, you're learning them at like the family level, and you're saying, okay, so that's definitely a hylid or a tree frog, or that's one of the rain frogs. And then as you go, you have to pull out these books and identify them. And sometimes you identify them like all the way down to like what you see in the coloration of their eyes, or what's underneath, like the flash coloring on the side of their body, or in between their toes, the shapes of their toes. And so you end up like having to really deep dive to identify some of the creatures that you find down there. So you can identify them down to like a certain level, but then you really need pretty extreme expertise to go beyond that sometimes. Some of the most common species down there are just the most vibrant species too, which is incredible. So like the red-eyed tree frog is really well known for that, with these like just absolutely gorgeous colors. The rufous-eyed frog is another one that's really absolutely gorgeous down there. The phantasmal tree frog. There's all these just absolutely fantastic looking frogs. So you're walking around and there are these little sort of gems throughout, jumping along the trails as you go, which is pretty incredible. One of the striking differences, though, is that there's really not high diversity of salamanders in Central America. So you find them in certain regions, and a lot of times you'll find them up in the mountains. And I'm certainly not an expert on this particular, like the distribution of these groups, but there are just fewer species down there, which I was totally shocked by. So we see way more frog species and different types of toad species, and then fewer salamander species in Central America. They're pretty incredible to find when you do find them, though. I remember finding a batch of Bolitoglossa on the top of a mountain, and we saw them the first year that I was down there, and that was 2008. And then I don't think they've ever been seen after that, which is really, really tragic. And I don't know if that's due to BD, or which is also known as chytrid, or if it was for a completely different reason.
Yeah, it's amazing how here in the United States, especially in the Southeast, the biodiversity with salamanders is incredible. And I didn't even realize that. But like you said, there's so many species of frogs in Central America. I mean, do you have any idea why that might be?
Well, a lot of that diversification happens because there are so many different types of resources as you go further down in the food chain. And so you end up with this really strong diversification of organisms not wanting to compete directly with one another for the same food. So then a small group of them will start to eat something else, and eventually they'll become two different species. And so we see this sort of radiation of species where we get a whole bunch of different ones in that same area. The sort of classic example of that is described like the Darwin's finches. One batch of finches landed on the island. They didn't want to compete for the same thing. And so they ended up eating different things. The ones that were successful eating different things started to diverge. And so we see that with other groups of organisms like the amphibians as well. There are just so many different places for them to live. So whether they're living in leaf litter and breeding up in bromeliads, whether they're in, you know, laying their eggs in the leaf litter and they don't need water at all, whether they're burying themselves and only coming out once a year to breed, or sort of calling from the trees and the vines. You know, they're all over the place and they each have their own sort of specialized role in the environment.
Did you see any dart frogs down there?
Oh yeah, there's a really great population in a couple of the field sites that we used to go to. In La Selva, which is a really well-known field site and biological station, the strawberry poison dart frog, also known as the blue jeans poison dart frog, the Dendrobates pumilio, the population there is just incredible. So as you walk along the paths to go in and out of the lab spaces or where you're staying, you'll hear the frogs calling all over the place. The erotus, the black and green ones, are also pretty much everywhere. They're a little more shy, so they're sometimes harder to see. And then there's some incredible populations of the Dendrobates pumilio in Panama, where you're sort of, they're coastal populations on these little islands, and they don't look anything like the species than the ones that you would see in pet trade here. I have some beautiful pictures of ones that are like yellow and green and black polka dots. They have ones that are black and purplish, black and blue, but they're all actually the same species. They've just diversified in terms of color. So it's just, they're absolutely incredible looking.
I know a few people who work with some of the pumilio locales and some of the other obligate species. And it's incredible because, like, when I first started to get into the dart frog hobby, you really only had the blue jeans locale pumilio. And then people started bringing in other locales. Like, I mean, I'm not much of a pumilio person myself, but it was like Red Frog Beach was one. And some of them came in. I'm like, this does not look anything like the blue jeans that I saw when I started out in the hobby, like, you know, 20 years ago. So yeah. Some of them are just absolutely incredible. Did you ever get the chance to visit those islands?
Yeah. So some of the islands, there's a whole bunch of islands out there. Some of the islands we would go to when I was doing research, and some we just went to for fun sort of during our off time, because they're just really wonderful places to go. I love with the pumilio thing. It really reminds you that humans like to categorize things. Like, we say this is a species and this is why it looks like a species and this is why we put it in that category. But nature doesn't always abide by the rules that we have created. And like, I just love that. I love those reminders where you're like, yeah, these all interbreed and they don't look anything like one another. So I guess they're the same species, but it's great.
Yeah, that's what's amazing about many of the species. Really, a majority of the dart frog species have so many different locales, like Tinctorius, Aratus. Mm-hmm. The Ranitomea species are incredible, especially with the imitators.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, they're pretty incredible there. And the areas where you see strong populations, they can be extremely abundant, too. And because they're often pretty diurnal, it's amazing to be able to just hike along. And you'll see movement or you'll hear a call. And you can sort of localize them and find them and watch them display to one another. And it's pretty awesome.
It must have been pretty incredible to see them out there. I mean, there's a few pumilio locales I know that aren't super brightly colored, but it must have seemed pretty impressive to have seen them all out there calling like that, especially in the middle of the day.
Yeah. And I mean, that's one of the things that's really nice with that group is that they're all diurnal, or at least most of them are. So they're so active that it's really easy to get out and actually see them. A lot of the species that I have worked with predominantly are nocturnal, which is good because I tend to like to be up late. But it would be, yeah, one of these days I should switch over to working with some of these really pretty diurnal ones.
I've talked to a few people who've worked with them out in the wild and people who've just I had a guest on the past, and he does kind of like ecotourism, and he'll actually take people to different locations to find different locales of dart frog. And then some of these locales are like tiny. I mean, it might be the size of like half of a soccer field.
Yeah. And then there's some that are even smaller. One of the places we went to see that species, or not the species, the coloration I was describing, that's the sort of like green and yellow, orange with the black dots. That population was just on one person's farm. And you had to go through like three different sets of barbed wire fence sort of paddocks. And it was like through a set of bushes, you had to climb down a little waterfall, and then there was a little rock scree area, and you would be able to find them there pretty consistently. I hear that population is actually no longer there, which is very sad. But you were always able to find them really consistently there, and they never really found them anywhere else. So it's some of those locations or those groups are in such tiny, tiny locations, which really then makes them very vulnerable when there's diseases that go through, or other, anthropogenic change and things like that happen to those areas, those populations, and potentially that entire genetic pool can disappear pretty quickly.
Yeah, I've heard about that from people who work out in Central and South America. There'll be a place there in April, and then they go back in October, and it's been all bulldozed and converted into agricultural land, and everything is just gone.
Yeah, it can be pretty tragic. And a lot of that stuff is, some of it has to do with ownership of land and things like that. And there's a lot of space that was left and not, it was sort of left and not tended, so it looks like jungle. And people, convert it over, or it gets purchased, or somebody takes it. Whereas here in the States, a lot of our land is already like sort of pre-delineated, and you know who owns what. There's very little land that's not owned by somebody here. And so the way land changes and land use changes happens in a very different manner here than it does in a lot of other countries, for better and for worse.
Yeah, it's just so sad knowing that this, you think about how many different locales and species that never were discovered just because they got wiped out before human eyes were ever set on them.
Yep. Yeah, that's definitely true.
Yeah, it's depressing, but why don't we get into Chytrid itself? Because I have heard so much about Chytrid, but I haven't heard, I don't want to say the real story, but you hear about Chytrid. But I really want to know the facts behind it. And some of your research, I read some of your abstracts, and there's some pretty interesting stuff. Like, I didn't even know that there were non-amphibian vectors like crayfish and other species like that. I mean, I want to get into that too, but why don't you start us out with the basics? Why don't you tell us about what Chytrid is, what's its life cycle like, and how is it transmitted?
All right. So Chytrid is an aquatic fungus that we would call a pathogenic fungus, meaning that it is a fungus that infects organisms and causes a disease. So generally speaking, most of our research has been done with amphibians. And so a lot of times when you're learning about Chytrid, you're learning about Chytrid and how it interacts with amphibian species. But it's a fungus that has an active zoospore, which is a small active spore that swims through, it almost looks like a microscopic tadpole, actually. It swims through the water, and it will sort of search out a host. When it finds that host, and that could be an adult frog, could be tadpole, and then there's a whole variety of other species we can talk about after, it burrows into the tissue of that host. For adult frogs, it typically lives in the skin, sort of all over the skin. For the tadpoles, it really sort of centralizes in the mouth parts. And so it'll go into the cells that are making the hard structures that they use as like scraping teeth for their mouth parts. Those zoospores, once in the host, will turn into a small cyst, and they send out like basically little fungal rhizoids, which are like a root-like structure, out into the tissue. They absorb nutrients, and they develop into sort of like a pocket that's filling up with more of the zoospores. different strains are found all over the world. And different strains, those cysts, the little pockets of the zoospores, which are called zoosporangia, they look different, but they almost all have what are called discharge tubes. And these tubes are basically like a chute. So when the zoospores are ready, the discharge tube has a little cap. The cap is released and all those spores come out. They can then reinfect the same individual, or they can move out into the water and reinfect another individual. So there's a bunch of different research on this, and how quickly the fungus grows sort of depends on what kind of host it's in, whether it's grown in media, meaning like in a culture with no host, what temperature it's grown at, what other things are in the environment. But it's sort of thought that the life cycle is anywhere between, say, 4 days and 12 days, depending on all of those different factors. And so you can see an infection in a frog ramp up pretty quickly. So if they were to, say, get infected with 1,000 or 1,000,000 of these spores, every few days you're going to see more and more of those spores potentially reinfecting them or infecting other individuals in the area. So their spread, the spread can happen in a variety of different ways. One, if you have an amphibian that has the infection and it goes into the water, going into the water will actually sort of dislodge some of those spores and they start to release. And so the spores will then be left in that water body and they'll move along. So it's what we would call shedding. So if a host that is infected releases something that is allows another individual to be infected, that's called shedding of those of that pathogen. So that's a term we hear a lot actually with COVID right now, is talking about shedding. When people are infected and they're breathing out, they're shedding that virus. So it's the same sort of idea that the frogs shed these zoospores into the water. They also can leave behind zoospores if they're, say, hopping along on moist soil, or if they come in contact with one another, they can transfer it skin to skin that way as well.
What about the lethality? What is the actual cause of death from an infection with chytrid?
So in the amphibian group, the amphibian system, typically for things like tadpoles, we actually don't see a ton of mortality. And that may be because the zoospores are only infecting the mouth part. So we see those frogs that they have a harder time eating, but they're still able to transition into the little metamorph and sort of into the miniature adult phase. The metamorphs, though, all have a really high level of mortality. So that's the phase right after being a tadpole. They look like a regular frog, but they're teeny tiny. At that phase, the zoospores end up going through the skin and they insist in the skin. And what happens when they're insisted in the skin is that water regulation and oxygen passing across the skin just doesn't happen the way it's supposed to happen. So they end up with these, like, basically their water and sodium, potassium, things like that, being totally out of balance. So they're not able to just regulate their body the way they normally would. So what that ends up leading to typically is malfunction in the heart. So they end up with basically what looks like a small heart attack. And that can lead to death in the individuals. There are other species that get the fungus as well. So crayfish can get the infection. And exposure to high levels of the fungus in crayfish actually caused their gills, the tissue in their gills to recede and pull back. And so that causes major problems for respiration. So that tissue, normally water flows past that tissue and then you just get this nice oxygen exchange. It's a passive thing where oxygen goes in, all the carbon dioxide comes out into the water as it passes by. But if the tissue is not there, you don't get that exchange. So the crayfish end up dying from basically not being able to breathe.
What about the timeline? And by that, I mean, let's just say that we introduce chytrid into a body of water. Let's just say that it's a pond that's there all year, not a vernal pool or anything like that. Pond that's there all year. Say we introduce chytrid in there and we have, let's just say we have a few species that are susceptible to it. What's the timeline from the initial, I guess, I don't like to use the word patient zero, but from the first infected animal to the point where it spreads through the whole pond and then outward and affects the immediate area outside that pond?
That is a really hard question to answer.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No, it's a great question. It's one of those ones that's really interesting, and every disease system, that's a really classic question. It's like, when an infected individual comes into the system, how quickly does that disease spread? But there are so many factors that influence that answer that it's really hard to give any sort of concrete answer for it. I can give you kind of a range, but it also depends on what those species are in the pond. And it depends on what other species are in the pond as well. So what other non-amphibian species are in the pond? So for a group like the Atelopus, which are really well known in this field for being very susceptible to the fungus, that meaning that they get the fungus and they die really quickly, you could see a population starting to decline in a significant way in a matter of weeks. So say 3 weeks and you see massive, massive decline. Some of the frogs out in the West as well have massive rapid declines as well. And so some of those really rapid declines are actually what cued scientists in just to thinking, okay, there's a pathogen or something is coming through and wiping out all these animals, because they would go and find dozens to hundreds of amphibians dead along the pond or along the streams. And so those amphibians disappear really fast when they die. Things come along and eat them. So if you're seeing massive amounts of individuals that have died along a stream, that means that they're dying really, really quite rapidly. So there are some species that are going to die in a matter of weeks. Other species are more tolerant to the fungus, meaning that they can get the infection. Bullfrogs are an example of this. They'll get the infection. They'll maintain it for the rest of their life. And so they may not have any issue at all with the fungus, and they just hang out with it. If you have a species that's like that in your system, they're going to be producing quite a lot of the fungus into the system. And so they're kind of what we call an amplifier, meaning that they're releasing a whole bunch of spores that are able to go and infect other species that are susceptible. And so you might see other species that are not as tolerant dying off faster if there's an amplifier in the system. So there's so many factors that can influence this. And this is something that has stumped a lot of researchers, that it's not the same. We're not seeing the same sort of mortality rates everywhere. Temperature impacts it. The species composition, quality of the water in terms of, are there pesticides? Is there a lot of UV exposure? Is it a good quality ecosystem? Are there other organisms in the ecosystem that can host it? Some of the other non-amphibian hosts, all of those things are going to influence how the disease spreads in the system, how quickly it spreads, how well it's maintained, how quickly it amplifies, all of that.
You actually answered what was going to be my next follow-up question, was about amplifiers. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I find the amplifier situation to be like the amplifiers in the system are really, really interesting. Go for it.
Oh, well, this is the thing that I never really understood. Okay, well, most diseases that are extremely lethal are usually self-limiting just based on geography, meaning if you kill all the hosts in a certain area, the disease can't spread outside that area unless one of them makes it out. You know what I mean? Like with Ebola, for example, Ebola really couldn't get out because it was so lethal. It killed people in that area before they could get anywhere and spread it. I mean, it's different now with international travel, but what I always wondered was, if you had chytrid come through and just wipe out a very, very vulnerable population of frogs, why did it persist in that environment? You kind of answered my question about the amplifier species like American bullfrogs.
Yes, they're a classic example of that. Xenopus laevis, which is an aquatic species. So if you ever went to the pet store and saw those frogs in the fish tanks that were swimming, those species also are really tolerant. And so they can get the infection and they don't seem to have any problem with it. And so there are a lot of species out there that are totally tolerant or, yeah, maybe we'll stick with them, that they're really tolerant and able to maintain it. The other side of that is that what you just described, that thought process of like, you know, a parasite typically doesn't want to kill off its host, because if it kills off its host, it doesn't have anything to live on and then it's going to die. That was sort of my thought process when we started looking at the non-amphibian hosts, because we were seeing that this fungus would persist. So there's a species in Dominica, which is a small Caribbean island. And they call it the mountain chicken. And it's basically because folks eat it. It's this huge frog. It's awesome looking. You have to definitely use two hands to catch it. And this species was totally decimated by BD. They waited a really long time to put the frog population back. So they had some in captivity. And they maintained them in captivity for years. And then they re-released them after several years. Theoretically, if the entire frog population is wiped out, you wait several years, the fungus can't live without a food resource, it should also disappear. But when they put the frogs back, they got the fungus again, and those released populations died off again. And so we started wondering, like, how many other options are there? There's either a stage where it's maintained sort of in the, like a spore of some sort, where it's just kind of an endospore idea, where it's just hanging out there waiting for a host. There's not a ton of evidence for that. But we started looking and finding it in a lot of freshwater invertebrates, for example, like crayfish. Crayfish get the fungus, they maintain it long term. When we expose them in the lab, a subset of the population died from the exposure to the fungus, and the ones that didn't die maintained the infections for months and months and months. They were also able to transfer that to another host. So sort of loop back to what you said a little while ago. If the fungus were wiping out its only host, you would expect it to disappear. And those really virulent pathogens, you would see over time they become less virulent, because the ones that were less virulent would be able to maintain their host population long term. The ones that were more virulent, meaning the ones that cause stronger disease, would wipe out their only host. But this fungus has other things it can live on, so it doesn't really matter to it if it wipes out the amphibian hosts, because it has all these other hosts that it can live on once the amphibian hosts are gone.
That's wild, because we always think about it as this very, very specific amphibian pathogen. I mean, even though it affects hundreds and hundreds of different species, we still kind of lump it all together as, oh, it's this amphibian disease, it's this amphibian disease. I was really, really surprised that it could be carried by and infect other species. So, we kind of touched on it, but why don't you get into that? Tell us about some of the non-amphibian vectors like crayfish and other species and what their impact is and how they're managed to, I guess, mitigate the spread of BD.
Yeah, so the take-home is they're not really managed. And so this is something, there are groups out there trying to work on this, but crayfish are a really sort of classic invasive species around the world. And so they are an ideal vector for something like BD, because it lives inside their GI tract. The crayfish, when they're able to survive with it, they do just fine. You could never tell that they were infected by looking at them. They're healthy, they're happy. In fact, we went to crayfish farms and sampled, and we found that there were BD-positive crayfish in the crayfish farms. And those crayfish get shipped all over the world when people, you know, want to have a crawdad dinner or something along those lines. A lot of times folks will take crayfish, they'll eat almost all of them, and they'll throw the last few in their pond or something like that, because it's kind of fun to have a crayfish pet, things like that. I've seen this in person myself. And unfortunately, those crayfish that are just getting thrown into the local pond, things along those lines, may be vectoring BD there as well. There's very little management of those populations. And one of the questions I get often when talking about this sort of system is, you know, if crayfish were killed by BD, so a subset of them dying when they're exposed to high levels of BD, wouldn't we have noticed their declines around the world? And one, we have seen crayfish declines. I don't know if they're due to BD because we weren't looking for that at the time. But two, they're invasive species, and we don't monitor invasive species the way we do our native species. So it's totally possible there were declines and we just didn't know about it. But there are a bunch of different potential hosts out there, and we are, I have a really nice grant right now from NIH, actually, where we're starting to look at what other hosts of BD are out there. So far, we know crayfish are a very strong host. We see 10 to 20% prevalence. Some areas we've collected in New England, in fact, we've seen 100% like prevalence. So when we go out and collect the crayfish, every single individual is BD positive. There's evidence that nematodes may also carry the fungus. There's folks who have gone through and swabbed and looked for potential like vectors or other groups that might be able to carry the fungus. And we haven't actually gone through and determined that they're true hosts yet. But when we swab some of the animals, and I can explain what that means in just a moment, things like reptiles, wading birds, we find that the swabs come back positive, meaning that they're carrying the fungus on their body. Whether or not that fungus could then be viable and infect something else later, we don't know, but we do know that they're carrying it with them on their body. So it's possible that they could be vectors for fungus or even hosts potentially. It's a new field. And there's just not a ton of regulation. It's really hard to get folks to regulate the movement of animals. Pet trade is one of those sort of systems that there's a lot of regulation in some ways and very little in others. So for something, when you talk about food like, you know, crayfish coming from crayfish farms and things along those lines, it can be really difficult to regulate that spread as well, which is it's a tricky system.
It is. And what you just said really intrigues me, especially about, I mean, the crayfish is one thing. And then the non-amphibian vectors besides crayfish, like wading birds, turtles, et cetera, anything that basically can get wet can carry it from one spot to another. But, I mean, I remember being younger. I haven't seen them in a while, but you go to an aquarium store and there would be a bunch of freshwater crayfish in with some unknown frog species or whatever. So you have to ask yourself, like, well, where did it come from? You know what I mean? Did it come from a crayfish that gave it to a frog that gave it to a crayfish? Did that crayfish get released into a local pond or whatever? It's just like, it's alarming to know that there's other ways besides amphibians that could be spreading this, despite all the management that has already gone into regulating the trade in amphibians, at least here in the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a really interesting conversation with a group who was trying to save hellbenders. And the keeper called me up and was like totally thrilled to read this crayfish paper, because he said that they've been bringing hellbenders into their facilities, clearing them of the fungus, which at the time they were using a fungicide or chemical bath to clear them, and that many of them did not survive the chemical bath, and so. They were losing individuals and they were clearing them of the fungus. They'd have them in captivity for a couple of months and then they'd get the fungus again. And they could not figure out how they were getting the fungus back into the system. And then they realized that they were collecting locally caught crayfish and feeding them with the locally caught crayfish. So they were accidentally reintroducing the fungus when they were bringing in those crayfish. So they were to change that and break that cycle, and then they haven't had to deal with that massive problem anymore, which is exciting when you see research that you're part of have a direct positive impact somewhere.
That's amazing to hear. You're right. It's like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You go through all these efforts to try and manage something, and then you realize it's coming in from somewhere else. It's so insidious. I mean, it was already intimidating enough as it is, and then to understand that despite all these precautions, all this management, et cetera, you can still just inadvertently bring it in from, just from a crawfish or something else.
Yeah, to the credit of the folks who have been doing this work since discovering it, because this is one of those systems, it seems like it's been around forever, but it really hasn't. The folks who discovered this are still really active researchers in the field. They followed the path that was most logical and the path that was most important, in that we were seeing these massive die-offs of amphibians. And so they started asking questions about amphibians and this fungus because those were the questions we needed to know at the time. And I sort of come in with this like privileged space where so many of these incredible questions have been asked over the last few decades, that now we start to get to ask some of these other questions that sort of maybe felt like tangential. At the time, it felt kind of like a boom or bust kind of experiment. Either we were going to find something really amazing, or I was going to put a lot of effort into something that was, didn't go anywhere. I was only really able to do that because conservation effort and conservation money is so limited, because the folks before who have been doing all this research ask so many of the really important questions when it comes to these species that are declining so rapidly. Now that we have figured this out, there's quite a few groups who are starting to do a lot more work with the non-amphibian hosts and vectors. It's really exciting work.
That's something I'd really like to see more of. And when we get to the end, if there's any resources that you could mention when we get there, I'd love to hear them, because now I'm really intrigued by this too.
Yeah, sure. I'll have to pick my brain and see if there's any good ones for the non-amphibian ones. But yeah, I'll think on that one for sure.
Yeah, because I mean, here in the U.S., we have, I think it was as of 2016, there was, 201 or 211 species of salamander were listed as injurious, the idea that they were going to prevent the introduction of B-Sal to the United States because our population is particularly vulnerable and it's just a huge diversity of species. So on the hobbyist end, a lot of people were concerned that it was going to significantly limit the trade in salamanders. And it's become a contentious issue, which is not the focus of this show, but it would be interesting if that ban took place, and yet despite all that, because of things like crayfish, it came here anyway. You follow my line of thinking here?
It's a really hard thing to figure out how to manage things. And this is something that, I've thought about a lot, and I am not, certainly not an expert on the management side. And I respect folks who make those decisions because they're really hard decisions to make. There's so many things that influence those decisions. And it's interesting to think about it because, in my lab, we're always looking for new hosts to the fungus. We treat everything we bring into our lab and everything we work with as potentially, catastrophic and could potentially be contagious. And so the students that I work with these amazing undergraduate students, and they're so careful and everything's bleached down and everything's cleaned. And then I think about it and kids are running around with buckets of animals, and they're taking them into their house and they're looking at them, which is such an important learning experience. And then they're putting them back out in the pond, but maybe it's not the same pond. And those moments make me laugh because I think about how meticulous and careful we are, and then how easy it is to move things around outside in the world.
Yeah, the human element is definitely compounds it. And that was going to be my next question, actually, was what's the casual human implications for that? By casual, I mean, like you said, let's just say that you go fishing at a pond, you wade in there, And then you walk out, you take your waders off, you don't bleach them down or whatever. Can you pass that to another pond? Will it eventually die off on surfaces once they're outside of water, or is that going to stay latent for any given period of time and you could bring it somewhere else and infect that body of water?
Yeah, so the fungus, so the one benefit from terms of like not spreading it from human perspective is that the fungus, if it dries out, becomes not infectious. So it needs to stay moist. And if it gets really hot, it also will lose its ability to infect things and die. So that's a positive in that if you were to say, go out in your waders and you put your waders in your car, your waders dry out, you go, you know, the following week out, you're not likely to spread it. The issue comes if you went out in your waders and you got a bunch of mud in the, you know, in the bottom of the shoe, and you went to one creek in the morning and went to another place in the afternoon, you could definitely spread it between those places if your waders are still wet and the mud on them is still there and wet. So it's, you know, there's some awareness campaigns out there. In fact, for things like white nose in bats, there's a ton of awareness campaigns trying to get folks to think about the fact that what we do in the environment really does impact the environment. I think we often think about it from our own experience perspective, but we don't stop and think about what are we moving from place to place? What are we trafficking and carrying with us? I just last year, right before the pandemic, in fact, I spent about a month in New Zealand, and I was so impressed with their system. They had in and out of each of the major places that people would go hiking and swimming, these cleaning stations. So you would step on this little cleaning pad and it would clean off your shoes so that you weren't carrying anything out of that space or into that space when you're hiking. I think it's really important that we are aware and that we make well-educated choices when we're doing things. I clean all of my field gear, although I remember really specifically in Panama, I had a student with me. We would have this really intense routine to be able to get in and out of the car so we didn't infect the car, but we had field boots. And we didn't want to bring our field boots to different places. So we had different field boots for each of the places we were going. We had bags to put them in. So we were doing this, you know, intensive sort of balancing on one foot, trying to get our car shoe on. And then you put your car shoe foot in the car and it can't touch the ground. And then you're trying to get this other one. So you're kind of slowly climbing into the car. And then these folks just drove up next to us earlier hiking. And they drove up next to us and they got out and just walked. And I was like, and my student and I laughed because we had just spent 20 minutes trying to make sure we didn't track anything from point A to point B. And here are these folks that we had just seen where we were now in the place we are again. So it's like, oh, yep. So they've tracked whatever they had from point A to point B, but at least we did not.
Yeah, it's a hard sell getting people on board with something like that. I mean, even just something so simple as like, look, just keep your boots clean.
Yep. That's sort of the best thing. Keep your boots clean, let them dry out in between going places, and you're going to have, you know, pretty low risk of spreading anything.
Have you ever seen frogs in the wild that have chytrid? I mean, if you saw a frog that had chytrid, could you identify it just as a, you know, as a layperson?
No. So it's a pretty invisible infection. Even in the lab setting, if we have frogs that we know are infected because we've dosed them directly and we've swabbed and we can tell that they're infected, you can't see the infection for the most part. There are other pathogens like rhinovirus, which is a virus that infects the skin layer and the mouth parts as well. You can see those infections. The frogs have a lot of like what we call manifestation of the disease. So you can see the redness and the swelling. But for BD infections, you really don't see it much. There are certain cases where you can get really severe infections, and right before the individual dies, you'll start to see different signs of infection. But generally speaking, you wouldn't be able to tell. You can see That frogs that are really heavily infected with any sort of pathogen tend to be very lethargic. They don't tend to hold themselves upright. So you imagine when you're sick with something, you kind of slump into the couch and you just want to curl up and hang out and not do much. When a wild animal is sick, they also are going to have the same sort of thing where they're sort of slumped and they're not holding themselves up alert and looking for things. Often they don't really go out and move much. So a lot of times when we have areas with amphibians that are sick, you just actually don't see as many amphibians because they're kind of just hiding out and not doing much because they don't feel good. But you wouldn't really be able to tell if you saw one that it was infected.
What about wild populations and resistance? Is there been any evidence that wild frogs are just, I guess, through natural selection, natural pressures, developing any kind of resistance, or are there certain, I'm trying to pull a word out here, but I guess, are there any individual frogs that are surviving this and then going on to reproduce and passing on that resistance on a genetic level?
Yeah, we're just starting to see some evidence of resistance. I think there's sort of been anecdotal evidence in smaller populations where we saw resistance developing over time, or like we noticed more, I shouldn't say developing over time, but we noticed that the population was doing well and those individuals seemed to be more resistant than their predecessors were. There are some species that are just naturally resistant. There's some species, if you were to squirt the fungus right on their back, they'd have no trouble and they really wouldn't get infected. So why those species don't get infected is still a mystery in a lot of ways. Some folks think it might have to do with the microbial fauna on their back. So there's lots of things that are living, like other types of fungi and bacteria that live in the skin. And so maybe those organisms help fight off infections. Maybe those frogs are just really good at defending themselves. So when they're exposed, they kill off the fungus really quickly and they don't get an infection. So some are naturally resistant. There's some really cool sort of mumbling amongst the scientists. I haven't seen too many papers out yet that there are populations in Central America that were listed as near extinct or thought to be extinct. I don't know what the number is, but in order for an organism to be called extinct, there have to be no sightings for something like 11 or 14 years. It's quite a long time. And so there are populations that people thought were extinct and totally wiped out in nature that they're starting to see come back. And so it's totally possible. There's some folks doing this work, and I can't tell you which direction it goes, but it's totally possible that those species, almost everybody was wiped out. The few that were resistant or the few that were tolerant, meaning if they could get the infection and not die, survived, and those few were the ones that reproduced and could come back and rebuild their population. So there's some evidence that we might be seeing some of that in nature. In my research lab, we also are inducing resistance. It's called acquired resistance, basically using a prophylaxis or almost like a vaccine. It is, it technically is just like a vaccine. We just, it's sort of the prototype to a vaccine. So we can actually give amphibians this prophylaxis or prototype vaccine, and they will then develop resistance. So if they get exposed to the fungus, they get a really low infection load that they can survive, or they don't get infected at all, which is really exciting, sort of promising new work.
Yeah, tell us about that. How did that discovery come about? And can you tell us about some of the procedures that go into inoculating a frog for BD?
Yeah, so I work with a handful of really interesting folks who have been sort of asking these sorts of questions for a really long time. And we just wanted to see if it was possible. If you gave the first study we did, and the first paper we have is like 6 years worth of research. It's one of those times if you get a big paper, like a high impact paper, sometimes you have to do like 5-6 years worth of research before you can put it all together to publish this big paper. But one of the first things we did was we took frogs, we gave them the actual infection, and then we cleared them of the infection. And so one of the cool things in this paper is that we went through and figured out that we could heat the frogs up, put them in like little incubators, and it would kill the fungus, but not the frog. And so we didn't have to use that horrible antifungal chemical to kill the fungus and risk killing the frog. So we were able to use this heat clearance, which was a really exciting method. But we would infect them, we'd clear them, we'd infect them, we'd clear them, and we kind of go back and forth. And the idea was we were hoping if we infected and cleared them a couple times, they would start to have lower and lower infections. And that's exactly what we ended up seeing. We then followed that up with another study where we wanted to see if we could just expose them to the dead fungus and then all the chemicals that the fungus produces. And the idea here was that we were going to have a really hard sell to tell folks, take your precious frogs that you've been maintaining in captivity for the last 15 years and infect them with this fungus that's wiped them out in the wild. That wasn't really going to be a great pitch for most folks, especially given how susceptible many of those frogs are. So we wanted to see if we could vaccinate or use this prophylactic that was like a dead fungus. So that way we're not actually exposing them to the live infection. And we found that that worked really well as well. In fact, it worked just as well as exposing them to the live infection. So then we've gone a step further and we've removed the fungus entirely. So now all we're exposing them to are the chemicals that the fungus produces. And it produces these chemicals when it's going, like getting ready to infect a host. So it just releases down into the water that the fungus is in. So we have the fungus in water, it's producing all these chemicals. We remove the fungus, and then we just have the water with all those chemicals in it. And we can actually use that as our prophylaxis or sort of prototype vaccine. And it also will convey this really strong benefit where if they get infected, it's a really low load. So they're not getting really high infections. They get a really low load, their body can fight it off most of the time.
Do you mind if I ask which species of frog you use for the experiments?
So we've done it with a couple different species. The two main species that we work with are Cuban tree frogs, which is Osteopilus septentrionalis, and then the Pacific chorus frog, which is Pseudacris rigilla. The reason we use those two species is that I was doing a lot of this work when I lived in Florida. And so the Cuban tree frog is an invasive species there. So I sort of predominantly used that species so that anything we were doing was also helping to pull invasive species out of the environment. So that was one of the major reasons we use that species. And then the Pacific chorus frog is a species that's really abundant in the West, out in California, for example. And it's a species that's known to sort of indicate how much fungus is in the area. So if you see those species there, you can swab them and you'll be able to get an idea of how much fungus is there. So they're sort of a good indicator for us. A lot of the areas that had high amounts of BD also had this species of frog, and they had high loads. So we thought if we could potentially work with this species, if we can vaccinate them, which we know we can now, we could potentially vaccinate them in the field, and then that would reduce the overall amount of fungus in the field.
Is that the ultimate goal here, is to be able to develop some sort of method to deliver this? I mean, it's not really a vaccine, but like, what would you call it?
Yeah, I mean, so it's funny, we have a lot of debates amongst my co-authors and I amongst ourselves on what to call it. It's we're in the route to be able to call it a vaccine. It is, in fact, the same exact idea as a vaccine. It's more like what we call a toxin vaccine, but it is in that route. We're just sort of still in the development phase. So I think you'd probably be best calling it either a prototype vaccine or a prophylaxis, meaning like a treatment that you give an organism to try to prevent a disease.
What would be the, I mean, I know it's still early in the research to be able to tell, but I mean, do you have any idea in terms of how this would be delivered? Is this something that you would just go into an area and treat a body of water? Would you go around and have to treat individual frogs? I mean, do you have any idea how this would pan out?
So there are, we have folks out in California doing the work this summer, which is cool. You could treat individual frogs, or you can dose the water that the frogs are in. So in theory, you could just pour it into the water where you have tadpoles and adult frogs, and they absorb it through their skin. So in the lab, what we do is just dose it directly into the container that they're in. So if they're tadpoles, we just pour it right in the water, and they absorb it through their skin that way. So it's actually a pretty easy to administer system.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'd love to see how that unfolds in the future, because it's become, especially with species like in the Atelopus genus, how lethal it is to them. I mean, as opposed to like American bullfrogs, which could essentially like live with it.
Mm-hmm.
Would you prioritize certain species like Atelopus or certain species of dart frogs over, say, like something that could live with it like bullfrogs? Or would you rather target those species since they're the ones that kind of maintain its presence in the environment?
You know, I think that you probably want to go in both directions. So being able to reduce the overall amount in the system is really important. To do that, you'd have to target the ones that have really heavy loads and maintain those heavy loads long term. But also you want to, if you want to be able to use it to be able to reintroduce species, you'd have to have a prophylaxis that you could give to individuals, say in a lab, prior to releasing them. And in that case, you would be more specifically looking at some of the Atelopus or some of those other groups that are being maintained with the amphibian projects and things like that in Panama, for example.
Atelopus was, I guess, chytrid was first detected in Atelopus when? Was it the 1980s or the 90s?
So it was described in the late 90s. But the declines had started to happen in a really rapid way in the 80s. And then research, as we've developed more and more of these really cool molecular tools, researchers have gone back and looked at museum samples and are finding it, into the 1800s. So it's likely that we saw BD around the world in different areas, going back probably earlier than that, but so far what we're seeing in these museum collections is, you know, the 1800s, 1700s. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of all over the place, and it is kind of, I think the way we're learning about it is by watching these populations decline, and we're going in and trying to figure out what was happening. And now we're starting to be able to look at it from broader perspective with more disease models and using more molecular techniques to be able to look at history and get a little bit clearer view of what was actually happening.
Yeah, we often compare it to, I mean, the analogy between this and COVID, I guess, is somewhat similar. But the more you tell me about this, the less I think that that's actually true, because COVID seems a lot more straightforward than chytrid. But in terms of it having started, or I shouldn't say having started, we don't really know, but having been detected as early as the 1880s, do you think that there were certain factors that facilitated it spreading, or that maybe caused it to be more virulent over time? I mean, do you think that issues like, say, like global warming or just different environmental pressures or pollution, et cetera, that might have had somewhat of a hand in it? I mean, because really, no one really cared until it started wiping out species in Central America. So do you think that there were other factors that caused, other factors at work that might have caused that event?
So, yeah. So there's a couple different lines of thought for what happened here. And I think that there's a couple different ways to think about it, and I'm not sure we'll ever be totally like able to totally unpack what actually happened. There's one idea that some form of BD was sort of globally distributed, and that it was a pretty mild fungus, that it would live in certain species, certain hosts, and it didn't cause massive problems. So species were kind of tolerant to it. Then one strain that was really virulent started to be spread around the world, and we started to see more of this virulent sort of phase where it's wiping out amphibian populations very quickly, sort of spreading around the world. Another idea is that it wasn't really ubiquitous. It wasn't all over the place, but in fact, it was actively spread. And there's different thought processes for how it was spread. We talked already about the potential for these non-amphibian hosts spreading it, but there's also things like those aquatic frogs I mentioned, the Xenopus laevis. We used to use them for pregnancy tests. So in fact, they would use those to identify if women were pregnant. The logistics of that are not totally clear to me, so that would be something you'd have to Google. But they would be shipped around the world in mass, and that particular species is super tolerant. So it's very possible when they got shipped around the world that they in fact brought the fungus with them and spread it. There are other groups that are African clawed frogs. There's some other groups in there. The firebelly toads are another group that was thrown out as potential pet trade species that, as they spread around the world, potentially also brought this fungus with them. So there's lots of different ideas for sort of how it moved. I remember watching folks when I lived in Costa Rica bring Gatorade jugs, and they would fill them up with crayfish, and they'd bring them to the top of a mountain and dump them in the stream, because after a few years, the entire stream would then be filled with crayfish. They'd reproduce and you'd end up getting this nice food resource and bait resource that way. And so it's possible that humans were also spreading it by spreading a lot of these non-amphibian hosts as well.
Yeah, it seems like people are always so quick to consider one factor as being the ultimate cause of this, and then you're right, there's so many other factors at work that you really wouldn't have even thought of that could even be more dangerous. I mean, something that's so simple as taking a bucket of crayfish and going up to a mountain stream and depositing them there, that there you go, you've done it, and you've contaminated every body of water that you entered from there on the way up too.
Yep, exactly. And, you know, I've encountered a lot in my career that folks will say, you know, like, you know, you said this in one paper, you said that in another paper, they contradict each other, which one is right? And I'm not thinking of a specific example exactly, but, you know, those sorts of moments and conflicts happen. And I think the reality is that sometimes both things can be true to that moment. Like I was saying before, that we'll see. There's so many things that influence how quickly the fungus spreads through a pond. It depends on that exact pond, what species in there, what temperature is, whether there's other pesticides, whether there's, you know, global climate change impacts on that system. There's so many things happening that influence how it moves through that system. But the same thing happens at a global scale, and the same thing happens across these disease systems, that we sometimes get conflicting results. Sometimes we get things that make sense in one area that don't work in another, or don't make sense in another. There's so many good scientists out there doing work. It's pretty incredible, but I think we have to try to keep that broader perspective and keep taking in information. Just like you mentioned with COVID, like a year and a half ago, we knew very little about it. You know, we had very little understanding. We took a bunch of guesses from other systems and previous experience with similar viruses, and we threw it on this system to try to get an idea of what might happen. As time went on, we had an idea of what was happening, and so we got more and more and more information. But it can be really, really, really complicated when you're looking out in these natural systems, trying to figure out what's happening, why it's happening. Like, why is it spreading? Why is it not spreading? It's really interesting.
Yeah, the more we talk about it, the more questions I have. Like I just had one that popped into my head. Like, what about the oxygen content of water? Does water that's well oxygenated and well aerated, does that facilitate the spread of chytrid more so than a pond that's stagnant? I mean, who knows?
Yeah, I'm not sure of that question. I don't know if anybody's looking at that. It's totally, there's so many people doing this work now that it's totally possible there is someone who's looked at it. But I don't know of that work. That'd be a cool question to ask, though.
Well, if you're out there listening, then there's your mission, people. Go figure that out.
We do know that exposure to pesticides is really bad. So people using pesticides on their lawns, when it runs off your lawn into local waterways, the amphibians are basically swimming in that cocktail of pesticides. And that messes with their immune system, it messes with their development, and they're sort of makes it so that they're not resilient and able to handle another thing coming into their system. So then they end up being really susceptible to these pathogens. So we do know that there's some sort of, when you have too many things happening in one system, too many stressors, the amphibians really do not do well.
What about testing? With COVID, at least here in New York, the amount of testing was just like astronomical. Testing. I mean, obviously testing doesn't cure anything, but it gives you some data. What about testing outside of the wild environment? Is it worthwhile for private collectors and people who exhibit amphibians to routinely test their collections?
You know, I've never actually had anyone ask about testing for like private collections. Zoos test their animals like crazy, and they, especially when they have new animals coming in, they will quarantine those animals, and they're giving them anti-helminth, so like getting rid of the roundworms in their systems, nematodes, things like that. Medication, they'll clear them a lot of times of the fungus, either using our heat method or using the itraconazole and the antifungal method. But then when they bring new animals in, they quarantine them for quite some time to be sure, and then test them to be sure that they don't have the fungus. If you are working with animals and you bring them into your population, you don't know where they came from, I would very much recommend trying to get them tested if possible. Interestingly enough, the testing is really similar to what they do for COVID. So for COVID, I'm sure most folks have had the experience of having a test at this point. But they, you know, you take a cotton swab and you swipe it along the part of the body where you're most likely to find the pathogen. So for COVID, it's inside the nostril. And then they use, they extract DNA from that, and they'll use a little code that says if you have that virus, the little code will show up in the test. We do the exact same thing with the fungus. We take a cotton swab and swipe it along the frog's skin. We then extract the DNA, and we're looking specifically for the BD genes and the code that comes along with their DNA. And that'll tell us how much they have, like if they have it or not, and how much they have. So we, interestingly enough, over the last year, have had a really, really hard time getting materials to do our research because we're using the same methodology as the COVID testers. And so, you know, I ordered plates to be able to run my samples and look at how much fungus is in my samples last August, and I just received them a week ago. Normally, it takes about 3 days to get them. So we're seeing these massive backlogs on scientific equipment. We have folks who are doing work out in the field in California, and they reached out in a panic because they couldn't get any swabs to do their research, because the swabs have all been sent off to COVID testing as well. So that's sort of a new hurdle that nobody expected in the research world.
Yeah, I never would have thought of that myself, although it does make perfect sense. I had actually purchased, I mean, just so that you know, a lot of serious frog hobbyists, myself included, we place a tremendous amount of value on the health of the animals that we keep, because we don't want anything coming in, going out, going side to side, wherever. So I do know of some keepers that do test their animals for chytrid fairly regularly. But I mean, for me on a personal note, I think that it's something that would be wiser if everyone did it, especially people who do deal with or keep wild caught or imports. And I did actually order a test from, it was a larger vendor who will remain nameless for the focus of this conversation. But they sent me a kit with a pair of gloves, a swab, and a requisition slip for the lab. You fill out the requisition slip for what you wanted the test for, and you enclose the check. I packed everything up, sent it out to the mail. Unfortunately, what happened was the address that I was given by that vendor, the lab no longer exists there. So I got the package back with a very angry handwritten letter from whomever had received it that the place wasn't there anymore. But that was kind of discouraging for me because I wanted to test out members of my collection, see if anybody had anything, you know, Kittred or otherwise. I think there was a test for rhinovirus in there. But do you think it would be in the best interest of hobbyists to sort of incorporate that into their protocol the same way that larger establishments like zoos do? I mean, do you think that would be just as valuable in the hands of the average person as opposed to someone who's in a scientific or zoological situation?
Yeah, so I think in particular, if you're bringing in specimens that aren't already established from a breeder in the system. So if you're bringing in wild caught animals, you're bringing in imported animals or animals with like an unknown origin, then I think testing is a really good idea. At least quarantining those animals is a really good idea prior to exposing them to your population. In fact, and I should have mentioned this before, that I used to, my mother bred Epibitobates tricolor, and she still does, in fact. So I have at least a little bit of experience, tangential experience, with some of these trade systems. And, you know, I think a lot of the bigger breeders do quarantine their animals before exposing them to others. But if you are bringing in animals and you don't know where they're coming in from, I think it's definitely worth testing. And testing for things like rhinovirus is probably also another really good one, although rhinovirus is not as, it's sort of another thing to unpack, but it's not as lethal, and you can usually see if there's symptoms a little bit easier. BD is pretty symptomless until the animal is really about to die, unfortunately. So yeah, I mean, I think testing is not a bad idea. I hadn't actually heard that there were folks out there doing a lot of testing or promoting that, but it's not a bad idea for sure.
Yeah, before I get into my next statement, but that's great. You said your mother breeds tricolors?
Yep.
Okay, I breed Anthonii, which I go on all the time about. It's like become a running joke on the show because I talk about them so much. So if you guys know, I mention that species all the time. And yeah, Mason, if you're listening, you'll appreciate this. I had a guest on the show a couple episodes back, and he said that every time I said Epipetobates anthonii, it was like a drinking game. So I said it so much, but that's great that she works with them. But the hobby faces some hurdles, and one of those hurdles is being able to justify keeping things that could potentially bring pathogens into the United States with unintended consequences. So my personal opinion is it really behooves hobbyists to develop some sort of a protocol to make sure that anything you bring in is tested and documented, and then tested again and then documented, a second and third time, just for the sake of being responsible. And then also it's going to hold the hobby up to a higher level. We don't want to be perceived as being these irresponsible people who just haphazardly bring frogs in and out of the country. And I feel like that method, although it would increase the price of frogs, but I feel like that would be a more sustainable long-term solution than just outright banning things or not doing anything at all and just letting nothing happen.
Yeah, but I think that there can be controlled trade that's really responsible, and I think that that's definitely the way to go and the thing to strive for. And I think with any system, there are folks who are really irresponsible with the choices that they make, collecting too many individuals, collecting individuals that may be sick, and just sort of grabbing a bunch in case a few die and not worrying about it. But then there's, on the other hand, many folks who are really conscientious when they're making sure that they're, you know, collecting healthy individuals, they're getting what they need and not too many, and then making sure to take care of those individuals and be really conscientious. I think that that latter version is a much, much better version from a conservation perspective. And there's something to be said for the fact that we fall in love with animals and we fall in love with the environment by seeing it, getting to engage with it, and having the opportunities to have those interactions. We can't have that without, like, you know, kids can't see what a frog looks like without going out and finding a frog, but they're not all going to be able to go out and see a poison dart frog in nature. So having the options to be able to see poison dart frog in an aquarium where they can see this super intensely bright colored frog hopping around, that gives them the chance to fall in love with that species and gives them the chance to start learning to care about the environment, start to think about how could they interact with those species, how could they interact with the environment in a way that would be like a good steward for the environment. You don't start to have those moments if the kids can't see those species.
Those are all great points. I, on a personal level, but well, before COVID, I've talked about this before, but I would do some local outreach with frogs from my private collection, and just seeing the expression on, I mean, you don't get to everybody. Out of 10 kids, you might get one who really, really takes an interest in the subject and just like, wow, these things are incredible. But even just that 1% out of that group of 10, it has so much value and it's so rewarding to see, especially young kids really get into it and become passionate about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. I mean, I think about it all the time. I was one of those kids, right? Like, I was given the opportunity to see these creatures and to fall in love with them. And that led to the entire trajectory of my life and career, and has been what's motivated me to try to do work that helps really conserve these species. And I try to think about that sort of in an outside of a traditional way. But without those opportunities as a kid, I don't know if I'd be on the same path.
Yeah, it's hard to say, but you are fighting the good fight. So I do thank you for that. And I do give you credit for that. So, well, we're kind of winding down towards the end. Is there anything else that you wanted to add before we wrap up? I know I asked you to mention something earlier before. I don't know if you want to just mention maybe some of the resources and some of the publications any of the listeners might be interested in.
So if you're, and correct me if I'm misremembering, you were asking about some of the publications and resources on the non-amphibian groups?
Yes.
There are a couple different publications out there. The crayfish publication is one. And in fact, I don't know if you ever put resources up. I didn't think to look on your website. If you put resources up, I'm happy to send some of these along to you. But the crayfish publication is one that we published in 2013, and it is published in the Journal of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. And it is sort of one of the first big ones that unpacks the idea that there's these non-amphibian hosts. There are some other groups out there who have published work. Roberto Ibanez is a researcher at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute, and he's done a bunch of work looking at waterfowl as a potential. He did work research as looking at lizards and reptiles as potential vectors in the tropics. He's a collaborator of mine as well, and has been a really incredible resource for me in terms of trying to get research done in Panama, and just a really incredible researcher himself. He runs a facility in Gamboa, Panama, and they maintain a bunch of species that are wild extinct, including many of the Atalopus species as well. So I'd highly recommend looking up some of his work as well.
Yeah, it'd be definitely interesting to see. I mean, on a personal level, I'm intrigued by that, but well. All right. Tegan, I want to thank you so much. It's been very, very informative. I think that I learned a lot. You know, I always find the topic interesting, and it was really intriguing to find out some of the real meat and potatoes of the issue, because I feel like so much of it just gets glossed over in the headlines, that it was really nice to get to know some of the research that's ongoing and some of the new developments and a lot of the facts behind the disease. So I thank you for that.
Yeah, and thank you for the opportunity to get to talk about it. I mean, I'm really passionate and I love it. And it's nice to be able to talk to folks and share the information.
Well, it was my pleasure. All right, everyone. I hope you enjoyed this one. It's been real informative, and I'll catch up with you guys again soon.